You're tuned in to Full Service Radio.
Full Service Radio.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service Radio.
Full Service Radio is proudly supported and hosted by Simplecast, the easiest way for a podcast creator to publish and distribute audio on the internet. For more information, visit simplecast.com.
You're listening to The Tidbit, brought to you by Curate. Live at the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, I'm your host, Kim Bryden. This is episode 5, y'all, and starting next episode, we're doing something a little different on The Tidbit. We are going to be featuring 3 different entrepreneurs for episodes 6, 7, and 8. They're going to be a caterer, a product-based business, and a farmer, but all food businesses in the DC and Baltimore metro areas. And what we're going to try and do here on the show is literally have you put your money right into the local economy. Could we even raise $1,000 for one of these entrepreneurs' projects? So think about it. Maybe you even donate the amount of a cup of coffee to get us there. And once you decide, once we collect those funds, you get to decide who then receives that money based on the projects that these entrepreneurs talk about here on the show. That's right. You get to vote on which project receives those funds. So stay tuned for the next episodes and please consider putting your dollars straight into the local economy by supporting one of these entrepreneurs. Head over to patreon.com/thetidbit. patreon.com/thetidbit. And if you want that direct link, or maybe you just want more tidbits of knowledge on what we're reading, eating, drinking, and learning beyond the show, The Tidbit is inspired by a bi-weekly newsletter that we send out at Curate. And this week is Ascend, so get on it. Head over to curateconnect.com, C-U-R-E-A-T-E, connect.com, and sign up in the footer. So sometimes at the top of the show, I share tidbits on what I'm reading or lessons I'm learning. But this week, I'm going to share about what I'm eating and more importantly, from where. So maybe it's because it's the winter and I try to eat seasonally, or maybe it's just because I love dips. I just absolutely love anything I can dip. Maybe it's because I'm an entrepreneur on the go and I don't want to eat bread all of the time or pizza, but it's just my go-to snack and thing I eat. And the thing I am craving right now is beet dip, specifically beet dip with za'atar and yogurt. It's phenomenal. And this one I'm noshing on right now is from Sunnyside Gourmet, which is a company, a local business based in Silver Spring, Maryland. But I'll get back to that in a second. Another crave-worthy beet dip that I absolutely love is from Maidan, and shout out to a woman-owned business here in the district over on Florida and 14th Street. And actually, Maidan just had an awesome shout out on another full-service radio show called Shift Drink by 2 of my friends, Matt Ramsey and Eddie Kim, so definitely check out their show as well. But yeah, aside from these ingredients being so soul-warming, root vegetables for the winter, or just dips being so spectacular, this product from Sunnyside Gourmet is particularly interesting because I traveled all the way north to the border of DC, all the way to Tacoma Park to get it. And Tacoma Park is on the Red Line, traveling north towards Silver Spring. And why I went to Tacoma Park is specifically what we're talking about on the episode today. We are chatting about co-ops. And I had to go to the Tacoma Park Silver Spring Food Co-op, fondly called TPSS, to fully communicate to you all the amazingness that our cooperative business structures. We've talked about how the retail landscape is totally changing. Amazon acquired Whole Foods Market. Kroger, another grocery store here in the States, is in talks with Alibaba. Alibaba is an online marketplace, sometimes compared to Amazon, but based in China. And if other smaller retailers can't or are finding it harder to compete on convenience and price point, how does one survive? And if you've gleaned anything from the tidbit thus far, I hope it's a strong understanding of the power of community. And I'm reading from the TPSS membership brochure right now. And at the top, it actually says, Co-op Stronger Together. TPSS Co-op is a member of the National Cooperative Grocers, an organization which includes more than 100 co-ops around the country that work together to optimize resources, strengthen purchasing power, and offer more value to owners. It's amazing. And when you become a member, you also get a list of 20-plus businesses who also provide discounts on their services. And it ranges from 20% off goods, 10% off, a free quick home energy checkup. I mean, it's awesome, the sort of perks you get by being a member of this community. I even see here Supergirl, and another shout out to a full service radio program here called The Leap. Sarah, the owner of Supergirl, was on the show a little while ago, so check that out. But that's what I love about this. What I love about co-ops, what I love about the food industry in particular, is that you've legitimately bought into a community, and you can find pretty much anything at TPSS. I mean, you can find any product you need, from cleaning supplies to wine to produce, in addition to being able to buy from hyper-local businesses like Chef Tony's of Sunnyside Gourmet, the dip I'm eating. He's based in Silver Spring, and actually, I met Tony a while ago, at least 4 years ago now, while I was working with another locally founded startup called Territory Foods. And, you know, at the end of the day, the thing I absolutely love the most is that this industry is so intertwined with real relationships and connections between vendor and supplier, between guest and owner, and I feel blessed every day to be a part of it. And so if you're ever sitting back and thinking, how do you stay connected in a world that constantly wants you to hide behind a screen, maybe you should consider joining a co-op. Think about that. So after the break, we are going to sit down with Rodney North, formerly the Answer Man of Equal Exchange, which is a democratically owned and governed worker co-op with 150 plus worker owners, and they did approximately $60 million in annual revenue. And he's a consultant to cooperatives. So stay tuned to find out more fun facts about co-ops and best practices on how to start one right at the break.
Today's break music is by Flash Frequency. It's called Sunset Lane. We'll be right back on The Tidbit.
Hello, Roddy.
Thank you for having me on.
Welcome to The Tidbit. It's pretty awesome in this space, right?
Oh, it's fantastic. This old converted church.
Yeah.
And they did such a great job on it.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
I encourage people to check it out.
Yes, absolutely. So I am personally fascinated by the ways in which we can apply tried and true business structures and models and sort of reimagine them for today's economy. So I'm wondering, do you have any historical examples of cooperative structures in business that are still applicable for today?
Definitely. And one of the for a little bit of historical context, three major economic concepts came out of the mid 19th century, and so bear with me with this little history lesson.
I love history.
So we have you took AP history. I remember you mentioned that. So we know about the corporation. So the modern limited liability corporation came out of the mid 18th century. So 19th. So did communism. Mm. We know how that turned out. And the other one is the cooperative model, which is like the great but invisible success of those three. So currently, over a billion people in the world belong to one or another kind of cooperative, doing trillions of dollars of business. Millions are employed by cooperatives. Even in the United States, many Fortune 500 entities are cooperatives, and people don't realize it.
Fascinating.
So everything from, you mentioned TPSS, mm-hmm. but the Associated Press, that's a cooperative.
Wow.
Ocean Spray, Organic Valley, your credit union. Millions of Americans wanted credit unions. Those are basically co-op banks. And so this has been checking along, and it's out there, but one reason I love doing these radio shows is that people don't realize that this is an option. Mm. And when it comes to food, co-ops are all over the place. And to get back to that history, the first modern cooperative is something called the Rochdale Pioneers. Mm. And a group of mainly unemployed blue-collar workers in England wanted to get a source of more affordable, unadulterated food. There was a lot of food scams back then, people substituting, you know, sawdust for flour.
Oh, gosh.
So it's like, this is a classic co-op story, is we got to do it ourselves.
Sure.
So they got together. It's like, we're going to start our own store, and we're not going to cheat ourselves. So the first co-op was a basic consumer-owned cooperative like TPSS. And that later, that became a model which has been replicated endless times into all these different industries, mm-hmm. into all these different forms. Co-ops owned by the consumers, owned by the farmers. Like I mentioned, some of those farmer co-ops, Land O'Lakes, mm-hmm. you know, Welch's. Mm. These are all farmer co-ops. You know, banks owned by the depositors, or businesses. It could be Ace Hardware or Associated Press that are owned by their business members.
Wow. And so how logistically does that work? Are there a certain amount of shares that are divvied up, or you buy in and everyone gets a vote? Like, give me some examples of how this structure comes about.
Well, because of its flexibility, it'll work out a little bit differently. Mm-hmm. But there are seven universal co-op principles, and one of them would be open and democratic membership.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, open and voluntary membership, democratic economic control, economic information. So let's say you and I and Jack, the producer, want to start a little business. It's a record store.
Mm-hmm.
And so we'd be the three owners. But as we expand, we bring in employees, they would be granted a chance to join too. We can't like just keep it to the three of us.
Uh-huh.
That would be like a partnership. It wouldn't be a co-op.
Sure.
And, you know, say Debbie, the fourth person, mm-hmm. would buy in and pay the same sort of investment that whatever we had put up.
Interesting.
Like, let's say we all put up $1,000 and we borrowed the rest.
Sure.
So Debbie would also pay $1,000. She would get one share. It's like, you've heard of like one person, one vote?
Uh-huh.
So imagine one person, one share, one vote.
Okay.
And no matter how big we got, like with Equal Exchange, by the time I left, it had been around 30 years, had 150 members. They all had, from the founder to like the new lady in the warehouse, it was one person, one share of stock, one vote on the big issues in front of the organization. You know, what are our bylaws? What do we do with the profits?
Wow.
Yeah.
That's fantastic.
So it's really just the, I like to tell people that with a worker co-op, it'd be as if Adam Smith and John Adams got together to write a business plan.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so the guy who wrote The Wealth of Nations and one of the creators of our Constitution combined democratic principles with mm-hmm. free market practices.
Mm.
It's really, it can be done. And in fact, people have been doing it for 160 years now.
Wow. Phenomenal. And I feel like that's, you know, I want us to delve a little bit more into the food aspect, because here at The Tidbit, we discuss ways in which to start a small business with a food lens. So how do some entrepreneurs in the food business put this co-op model to work? I mean, you mentioned Ocean Spray as an example. So, yeah, do you have any more larger organizations and maybe how they've done it before? What do you think about that?
Or if I can, because so much of the focus of your work and The Tidbit is on small business.
Yeah.
So, and you were talking about bodegas on an earlier episode.
Yes.
And so like here in Mount Rainier, there is Glut.
Oh.
So that is a worker cooperative.
Where is Mount Rainier?
So just outside the D.C. border.
Perfect.
Near Hyattsville. And so there's the Glut food store. Now, not surprisingly, they carry equal exchange products.
Oh.
You know, because that's, it's called the seventh co-op principle, which is cooperation among cooperatives.
Mm-hmm.
So there's the co-op retailer buying from the co-op coffee roaster food importer.
Yeah.
Equal exchange, in turn, as a, you know, food importer, they import bananas, cacao, sugar, coffee.
Mm-hmm.
They buy all of that from farmer cooperatives in about 26 different countries around the world.
Wow.
So you have co-ops selling to co-ops selling to co-ops.
And talk about transparency in that supply chain.
Yeah. So I encourage people to check out equalexchange.coop.
Mm-hmm.
That's just one example. But back to sort of small business. So we mentioned Glut. Before moving back to the DC area, I was living up in Providence, Rhode Island, and my local bodega was a, it's, they wouldn't call themselves a bodega. It was a, up there, we'd call it a spa.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Which means like local small food store.
Okay.
And, that was a worker cooperative, and they rented a formerly vacant spot. And coincidentally, the focus was on, locally sourced organic and fair trade foods.
Hmm.
But that just happened to be their angle.
Sure.
So that's a small scale retailer. Also in Providence, so we lived in a neighborhood that had a lot of vacant lots and urban farming was really catching on.
Hmm.
Now you can imagine if you're, and a lot of those were all entrepreneurs. These were young people starting new ventures, but it was urban farming. If you have maybe a half acre lot, That's a hard business to manage. It's, you know, even if you have a good crop, it's hard to line up consistent customers.
Absolutely.
And yet there are local restaurants, as you know, who want to source locally.
Exactly.
But it's hard to like rely on the farm down the street for all your carrots. So what if, say, five of these local urban farms got together? They would improve the ability to deliver a product on a consistent basis.
Right.
They could have a broader supply. So five of these got together to create little city growers. So they're all independent little farm operations. But in terms of supplying the local restaurants, they did it through this co-op business. And so, you know, you have a restaurant and you want arugula through the summer. It's like, I don't know which of the five farms is going to deliver it, but I know that one of them will.
Right.
And
they've pooled all of the arugula together in order to then meet their customer demands.
And the way that they market or fulfill contracts, that's up to them.
Sure.
But the point is, you know, what TPSS said, co-ops, stronger together.
Absolutely.
So these little growers were stronger together. They were doing together what they couldn't do by themselves.
Right.
And most every business function can be done in a cooperative fashion.
Hmm.
And if you want, I can riff on more about like just going with small local food retailers and the ways that they could collaborate.
Well, after the break, I definitely want us to dive into that and specifically talk about local Baltimore and DC examples. So we'll be right back.
More music from Flash Frequency. This one called Shadow Fox. We'll be right back on The Tidbit.
Welcome back to The Tidbit. We are sitting down with Rodney North and we're chatting all things cooperative business structures. And hey, Rodney.
Hey there.
We have been in a lot of public-private sector stakeholder group meetings together in the District of Columbia discussing ways in which we can create more equitable systems for small business owners to survive and thrive. So why do you think co-ops are particularly important business structures for small businesses to consider?
Something that we talk about a lot is like the threat of the big. You know, you mentioned earlier Amazon. Mm-hmm. And I guess it's self-evident the way a small business is challenged by the mega corporation.
Exactly.
That straddles borders and is indifferent and disconnected from your local neighborhood. And so sometimes folks give up hope. You know, like there's no way the mom and pop business can hold on in the face of that. So let's take a look at, you know, one of our favorite local stories, which is Logan Hardware.
Yes.
Run by Gina Schaefer and her husband.
Where is Logan Hardware?
So most of the Ace Hardware stores in D.C. are part of Logan Hardware. Mm-hmm. So it's a family-owned business. They also are increasingly, they have a number of stores in the Baltimore area.
Amazing.
Yeah. And so we don't, okay, let me back up a little. The largest sort of seller of hardware products in the country is not Home Depot or Lowe's, it's Ace. And Ace is a cooperative owned by 1,000 or more local, you could say mom and pop, family owned hardware stores. And so together, they have a scale that, of course, you know, like Logan Hardware with 15 stores would never have. You know, mm-hmm. if you have 15 stores, you don't have the buying power to get the discounts on grass seed and shovels like Home Depot does. But 1,000 together, they have huge volume, and they can compete on price. They can also market together in a way that. So, I mean, I grew up watching you know, weekend sports, and there'd be TV ads from Ace and True Value. True Value was also a sort of a co-op of small businesses.
Fascinating.
But that together they can sort of be on the big scale. I mean, they are on a big scale, but they're still locally owned. And it's not a surprise that you don't see a Home Depot, you know, here around the corner in Adams Morgan. But, you know, in a neighborhood like this, you could find, you know, your small family hardware store.
Absolutely.
And so that can also be applied to retail. Mm. I mean, to food mm-hmm. retail. For example, for a long time, a lot of what we now call bodegas, you know, sort of small footprint grocers, were Jewish run. And here in the district, one way that they sort of hung in there against the growth of Safeway, Giant, A&P, was that they had a buying co-op.
Fascinating.
And I don't know when it started. It finally petered out, I think, in the 60s or 70s. Mm. But for a long time, that's how they achieved economies of scale.
Right. And economies of scale being that, let's say, 20 of these stores together then were able to purchase lettuce or jam or whatever it is, because now they're the purchasing power of 20 different stores and not just one.
Right. And imagine the efficiencies. Instead of having 20 people placing orders for peanut butter,
exactly,
they can all get it through their co-op.
Mm-hmm.
And so this was something I was looking into earlier this year about how the co-op model can benefit a small local business. It could. There's no reason it couldn't be replicated again.
Right.
One thing that often helps with co-ops is that there's some sort of connective tissue aside from just the business function. And so one reason I mentioned that most of those small grocers were Jewish was that was part of that connective tissue that helped to build trust. It's like such that they could go into this business venture together.
Or with TPSS, the Tacoma Park Silver Spring Food Co-op, maybe the connective tissue is that it is this hyper-local neighborhood. So you buying into it, the discounts you get at the other businesses in the neighborhood, you know, it's all to support that sort of mile radius of your neighbors.
Yeah, the food co-ops, the consumer-owned food co-ops tend to have a great a sense of local identity mm-hmm. and local pride and a desire to see a vibrant local community. So with most of our bodegas here in the district, they'll either be a Hispanic or Korean run. Mm-hmm. And there's
Ethiopian.
There's that too. Mm-hmm. That was not one I learned about. I did learn there is a Korean Grocers Association. Mm. And it kind of makes sense. What is it that we can do together? We can't do apart, sharing lessons or advocating for something. And that can be a building block to create or to recreate one of these small business co-ops that would help your local bodega stay in business, continue to serve the community, improve their viability, which would really be a win for everybody.
Yeah. There's a co-op purchasing organization that works with churches, I believe. What is the name of it? I can't recall.
It's called Community Purchasing Alliance.
Wow. Okay. Call it what it is.
Yeah. So CPA.
CPA.
So not what you think. It's Community Purchasing Alliance. Great website, cpa.coop.
Uh-huh.
And so there, they pulled together what is now over 120 local churches and synagogues and charter schools. Together, they buy more than 8 different kinds of things. Power. And they're getting huge discounts on their utilities because they can bargain now.
Fascinating.
And that's something you can do in the district. You can't do in every jurisdiction. So they're saving thousands, like per church, depending on their scale, on utilities. They can jointly purchase hauling their waste, landscaping services, photocopiers.
Cleaning supplies.
All of that stuff.
Yeah.
So check out cpa.coop. And that's been a booming success, just applying, and again, the co-op model, doing something together that we were doing alone. We were spending way too much, and there's just no end of the ways it could be applied for food, whether it's on the growing, distribution, processing, importing, marketing, retailing. It just goes on and on.
Yeah, definitely. So if our listener runs a small business or has dreams to start one, can you share a few best practices from your time at a worker owner, co-op, equal exchange, or examples that you've seen in various communities of elements that you've seen that have gone well or maybe things to avoid, or even from your sort of systems level consulting work now, what are things that people really need to look out for?
Well, the first one is, please just consider the co-op model. Mm-hmm. Is there something that you're doing that could be done with others who sort of, like often we look at what's the pain point? The pain point being, I pay too much for this, or it's too inconvenient. Increasingly, baby boomer business owners, say that 3 times fast backwards, are realizing they can't find a buyer. Even if they have a successful business, they can't find a buyer for it.
Because they may want to retire and get out of the business.
Sure. Yeah. People call it the silver tsunami. These are businesses, often small businesses, that are potentially going to just close for lack of someone to take it on when the owners retire.
Fascinating. Same with farmers. I mean, yes. Farmers are increasingly aging out.
Right. The new ones aren't replacing older farmers fast enough.
Right.
And so this is happening with small businesses. And there are groups, for example, one's called, 50 by 50, which are trying to encourage these owners to explore selling to their employees. Mm. So imagine if currently you find no buyer, well, that's bad. So any buyer is better. But what if you could reward your loyal employees by creating this opportunity for them to become owners, which would mean a lot to them, I think, not just financially. They get to keep a job, which is better than not, but become owners of the business they've already been working in. And also, I think there's an emotional uplift to becoming an owner. And think of the benefit for the neighborhood. So instead of a vacant shop or the local business, becoming a Subway sandwich shop, that it carries on providing the services that it has. Mm-hmm. If you're in local economic development, you're in the city council, you don't want to see a vacant spot. You don't want to lose the sales tax or the other taxes that are coming from a successful business. So really, selling to your owners can, logistically more possible than ever, There's a lot of groups out there trying to make it happen from the banking side, the legal side. People like myself provide services to help people understand how an employee-owned business will be different.
Yeah, to walk through all of those steps and processes.
Yeah, so yeah. To get to your original question, consider co-ops, check it out. Think about what you could do together. It could be buying with other small businesses. It could be like a conversion. And also for entrepreneurs, they could look at any of these co-op angles. Like, well, maybe I really want there to be a food store, but I don't want to be an owner. Well, maybe the consumers can be the owner.
Mm.
There's so many ways of looking at it. You have to familiarize yourself with it a little bit and go talk to people. There's something about in the co-op model where people are very happy to share their stories, their advice. You don't need to figure it out. It's not proprietary. You can find somebody who's done what you're thinking about, and they'll tell you, we did this, this, and this. There's a lot of resources just out there for free, like institute.coop.
Oh, okay.
They provide all these resources for new or existing worker co-ops.
Fantastic. We put up show notes on our blog after, so I'll link to that.
Yeah, so check it out, inform yourself, and be patient. Give yourself a chance to learn about how the co-op model might apply to your food business.
Yeah, and we mentioned, you know, even if it's not a food business, we talked about group purchasing in other industries. And I also want to give a shout out to two co-op models that are specifically around temporary labor. So there's Tight Shift Cooperative here in DC, and there's also one in Baltimore called Core Staffing. And both of these co-ops work with returning citizens, individuals that were formerly incarcerated, and they are owners of this organization, Tight Shift or Core Staffing. And they go after either temporary labor jobs together. It could be landscaping, it could be food service,
moving,
whatever it may be. But they together are creating this business structure together to start on a new path of employment. It's phenomenal.
Yeah. And a common thread through much of this is that co-ops often come up or are created where the market is failing. Market's failing. So like with returning citizens, the job market isn't working for them. For many farmers back in the day, and often still, there are these oligopolies. There's a handful of buyers, you know, Tyson, Purdue, ConAgra, Cargill, and they have all the purchasing power. So when farmers get together, they can begin to challenge that, find alternatives, find better markets. And likewise, a lot of the insurance market happens within the co-op model. So you hear about mutuals, Liberty Mutual, Mutual of Omaha. These are insurance companies operating on the co-op model.
Fascinating.
So again, the commonality being like, is the market working for me? Does a co-op path offer an alternative?
Hmm.
And there's a lot, I was doing this research this summer, there were co-op leaders and other consultants who didn't know about some co-op options. Like there's a purchasing co-op that almost any business can join, formerly called Biz Unite. They have a new name and it's so new I forget it, but you can Google Biz Unite. And that's an option for small businesses to buy non-core items. So yeah, whether you're a hardware store or a record shop or an accounting firm, you might go to Biz Unite, join, and get access to better prices.
Fantastic. So in closing, is there a way that if somebody is interested in starting a co-op or learning more, how can they get in touch with you?
They can write to me at rsterlingnorth@gmail.
Perfect.
or they can send a message to your blog and you know how to reach me.
Yeah, amazing. Like,
where's Rodney?
Yeah. Who is that amazing guy that talked about new business structures? Well, thank you all for tuning in. I hope that throughout our time on the tidbit, this has inspired you to rethink, current systems that we believe are the only way of doing business. So consider a cooperative structure for your main business structure or to optimize or improve a certain part of your process that you feel like is causing you a lot of grief and strife right now. Maybe you can be like TPSS's brochure, Stronger Together with Other Small Businesses. So until next time, y'all, remember to scale thoughtfully and source locally.
Thanks for listening to this program on Full Service Radio, broadcasting and recording from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. Full Service Radio programming can be accessed live and archived on fullserviceradio.org. Our talk programming is available on most podcast apps like iTunes and Stitcher, and our DJ sets are available on mixcloud.com/fullserviceradio. Full Service Radio features over 30 weekly shows and over 50 local hosts covering every topic imaginable. If you want to be a guest or get involved, email us at info@fullserviceradio.org. Follow us on Twitter @FullServiceRDO, on Instagram and Facebook @FullServiceRadio. Thanks for listening.